Thank you very much.
Does everybody have a handout?
What?
Okay. So, as I said last time, I'm just talking about issues rather than presenting halacha. I wanted to look at a couple of more cases in these discussions about the unethical client, coworker, boss. I do want to note also that next week, God willing, Yair Manis from the YU Beit Midrash will be here, and he will be speaking on May a Jew Own Stock in McDonald's, the issue of how halacha views corporations, with all sorts of ramifications for that. And then the following week, Rabbi Baruch Weintraub will be here talking about the gifted accountant, the pitfalls of swag, the swag being gifts that are given to various professionals. Last time, we first talked about non-professional advice to someone who plans to break the law. And we talked about the question of rebuke and keeping somebody from sinning. We said if somebody violates the law knowingly, then perhaps you don't have an obligation to go further and keep him from violation. And then we had a second case where you have a professional relationship with someone who's doing something illegal, and you are a somewhat knowing participant, so that you are an accountant and the person whose taxes you are doing presents you with charitable gift receipts, and you look at it and say, well, that's unrealistic, and they give you a wink. So you know what's going on, even though the person has not said anything explicit, and the concern there is that you are aiding and abetting in their act. It was either called mesayeya, assisting, or machzik yedei ovrei avera, helping somebody, holding the hand of somebody who is sinning. And we said this would be a problem if you enabled the person's sin, even if your participation is not required for it to happen. We compared it to buying stolen goods off of a thief. I should note, if you take a look at source number one on the sheets this week, I found the rules of professional conduct from the Institute of Chartered Accountants of Ontario, and there it actually says, a member, student, or firm shall not sign or associate with any letter, report, statement, representation, or financial statement which the member, student, or firm knows or should know is false or misleading, or not the signing or association, whether or not the signing or association is subject to a disclaimer of responsibility, nor make or associate with any oral report, statement, or representation which they know or should know is false or misleading. So to me, that actually echoed this point, that the official, I don't know how binding these are, it sounds like they are binding. The official rules of professional conduct are in agreement with what we said halakhically, that if you know there's something fishy here, you aren't supposed to be party to it. I did want to revisit, though, the discussion about rebuke. We had said that one is not obligated to rebuke, potentially, if the person who is sinning knows full well what they're doing. They're doing it intentionally. We said maybe you have to rebuke once. That was the view of Tosfos that we presented. But I wanted to revisit that because of the fundamental question of my obligation to rebuke, where that could have financial repercussions for me. What if, by offering my thoughts, I could end up losing the account or losing my job? So, take a look, please, at source number two. This is a responsum from Rabbi Yaakov Weil, the Mahari Weil from 15th century Germany. And he was asked how it is that, in fact, we don't rebuke much. We see people who do things that are wrong, that we believe they should not be doing, and yet we don't tell them, hey, what you're doing is improper. So he writes, as part of his responsum, Im hayinu mochim biyadam, were we to protest, igal amechash lesakana, there would be concern for danger. Shayu'omdim aleinu al gufeinu va'al me'odeinu, because they would stand against, they would attack our bodies and our possessions. Etc. The fact that the Talmud says, if you can protest and you don't protest, all sorts of terrible things happen to you. That's where there's no danger. But if there's danger, then you don't need to go there. And he said danger, whether that's physical danger or whether that is financial danger. He bases this point on three sources. His first source is a passage in the Talmud in Kiddushin, source number 3, in which, it's kind of a comical story, there's a back and forth battle involving the Jews of Babylon and the Jews of Israel. and this is, we're talking here in Talmudic times, it's sort of a question of primacy and who is to be seen as the real center of Judaism. So that during the time of Rabbi Pinchas, they wished to challenge Babylonian Jewish lineage as compared to that of Israeli Jews. The idea was, you're marrying somebody from Israel and they claim to be Jewish, you know for sure that they're Jewish. Whereas you marry somebody from Babylon, you have to investigate. That's what the sages wished to say. And Rabbi Pinchas disagreed. And so Rabbi Pinchas told his servants in source number 3, after I make 2 statements in the study hall, put me on a litter and run. This is a hit and run. I'm going to make 2 statements, and then after that, get me out of there before anybody can start arguing with me. So he entered and said, there is no biblical source for the shechita requirements of a bird. The laws of kosher slaughter, as of pertaining to birds, there is no biblical source for the requirements that we have. That's an open statement. It's obviously a statement that's going to cause, you know, a lot of consternation among the sages. So while the sages were examining this statement, he added, all lands are of questionable lineage compared with Israel, but Israel is of questionable lineage when compared to Babylon. Israeli lineage is not as clear as Babylonian lineage. So he throws that in while they're all distracted, right? It's the equivalent, it's the Talmudic equivalent of look over there, right? That's what he, all those people watching on video who just looked over there, but that's the, that's the what he does to them. And they put him on the litter and ran. The sages pursued but could not catch him. So once he's made the declaration, apparently it has some kind of standing, and now they're required to actually accept what he's saying. It's odd. It's not clear what the dynamic is that his statement has anything now once he leaves. You could say, well, you know, somebody said it, but we didn't get to discuss it with him, so it's meaningless. That's not what happens. They then convened. The sages convened and investigated Israeli lineages. They said, let's look into this. Maybe indeed our lineages are questionable. Until they reached a point of danger and then desisted. And the commentaries explained the danger was they discovered that indeed there were powerful families among Israeli Jewry whose lineage was questionable. And they, meaning that they were, there was concern for mamzerut, for inappropriate marriages resulting in illegitimacy, and they said, you know what? We're not going to investigate any further. We think that we've seen enough. So they back off. So that's one of the sources that Rabbi Weil quotes in source number, in the response I excerpted in source number 2, to say, you see that when you're reaching the point of danger, you desist. He brings other sources as well, which we don't have much time for, but that show that the when it comes to spending money, it seems that if the Torah doesn't say explicitly you must spend money for a mitzvah, as it does in the case of lo samod al dam reyacha, don't stand by your brother's blood. If someone is in danger, you are obligated to spend money in order to save him. But if the Torah doesn't say so, you are not obligated to do so. That's the governing principle, he says, and the Torah didn't say you have to spend money in order to teach people the proper path of behavior. So if you know someone is doing something unethical, something wrong, but your protest would lead to you losing your job, you're not obligated to lose your job in order to protest. That's the argument based on the words of Rabbi Weil. And take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Rama, writing in the Ashkenazi portion included in our Shulchan Aruch, our Code of Jewish Law.
Are these all over rabbinic issues, or are these across the board?
Apparently across the board. He says, Mikol Makom, after previous comments, he says, still, B'davar sheyesh chash sakana, where there is concern for danger, Ein tzarech lautzi mamono al zeh, one need not spend his funds for this purpose of rebuking. If it will lead you to lose money, you do not have such an obligation. I should note source number 5. I'm sorry that I'm going so quickly, but I do have the firm deadline. The Pitchei Tshuva is a commentary that's included on the bottom of the page in a standard edition of the Code of Jewish Law. It's, as you see here, from Rabbi Avram Tzvi Hirsch Eisenstadt, 19th century Poland. He collected earlier responsa and noted them on the Code of Jewish Law, where they pertain to the statute under discussion. So he quotes here the work Bechor Shor to say, "Divrei Mahariv," the words of this Rabbi Weil, "Lo ne'amru ki'im bebarei hezeka." That only applies where there is clear danger. Not where you just think, well, maybe, you know, things might, I might be in trouble. I might get a bad review down the line because I spoke up, because I blew the whistle. That's not where it applies. It applies only if you know for sure that it would cause harm for you. Because, he says, there's a biblical law of lo taguru mipnei ish. You should not be afraid of others. You should act for what's right and not fear. So he says, obviously that means there are cases where there is fear, where you're still supposed to speak up. So he says, the only justification, if we could pass down another story sheet, the only justification for not speaking up is if one knows that there's a clear and present danger, to borrow a phrase. So so what we talked about last week, right, the case of potentially losing one's job for the sake of rebuking, the answer based on this is that one would not be required to do so. What if he wouldn't lose his job, but he would take an economic hit? Right, the case we gave was of the independent accountant who has a client, and the client furnishes charitable tax receipts that are fraudulent. And when you speak up, you can lose the account. They're going to say, "Well, forget it. We're going to go somebody else." You're not losing your entire livelihood, but you are losing money. So how far will we go? Take a look at source number 6. True. Technically, you could argue that you're losing the chance to gain money. We do differentiate within Jewish law. We differentiate between missing a chance at profits and losing actual funds. The question would be, will I view the investment I have made in becoming an accountant and advertising my services as funds that are now lost because I didn't get a return on it? It's an interesting question. I don't think it's straightforward. But take a look at the language of Rav Moshe Isserles in source number 6. Very similar to what we saw in source number 4, but with a variation. He says, even though one is obligated to rebuke, to protest when people transgress, one is not obligated to spend for it. And what he omitted here from what he had in source number 4, if we had more time, I would actually ask you. But the difference between 4 and 6 is that in 6 he didn't mention any danger. Even if there isn't danger to you, but you will simply lose funds, you're not obligated to protest. On the other hand, the second half of what he says in number 6 concludes, therefore the practice is that we are lenient and we don't necessarily protest. Why? Out of concern, lest they attack our bodies and our possessions. So there it sounds more like it's a dangerous situation and it's not just a small loss involved. So it's not clear how much of a loss is actually considered to be the threshold. I should note, again, in source number 1, we saw the rules of professional conduct. They didn't make any distinction at all. You're not allowed to be involved in anything misleading. False or misleading, or anything that you should know is false or misleading, having nothing to do with your statement of, well, I'm going to lose my job. So in this sense, halacha halacha is not more lenient. The reason why it's not is because we're dealing with two different cases. We're dealing with two different cases. The case that we dealt with, the case that they're addressing in number 1, is where you are actually involved in perpetrating the fraud.
Or you're associated
with it. Right. And there, halacha would say, you can't perpetrate fraud. The case that the Rav Moshe Isserles is dealing with, where he provides the justification, is the case of of protesting somebody else's unethical conduct. So those are two different things. So maybe the answer is that the rules of professional conduct would not require you to speak up about somebody else's actions in the event that it would mean losing your job. I mean, there are protections for whistleblowers that are meant to prevent that, but still. I wonder what they would say. Okay. That's just, all of that is just revisiting last week's discussion about the obligation to rebuke. We have two new cases for this week. The first is...
By the way, I should just say, there is an obligation of the Institute Chartered Accountant Rules to inform the Institute if you're aware of another person doing something incorrect. Another accountant. Just an accountant, not an accountant. So that's a professional rule that says that, if, in the course of your work, you find there's another professional CA who you know does did something really wrong, you're obligated to respond to report. And if you do not report, then you can lose your license.
Right.
Do not report.
Got it. Okay, so that's worth knowing. It doesn't touch on the rebuking case, but it does in terms of the whistleblowing. Please note, again, we have a sign-in sheet here, and especially because I'm going so quickly this week, I want to make sure I'll be able to follow up afterwards. Anybody who comes in, who came in after we went around, please do provide your name and email address so I can follow up afterwards with additional information. Here's our case. It's at the bottom of the first side. Janet is an independent auditor, and I thank Steve for his help in coming up with this case. Janet is an independent auditor who often uses the services of Bill's valuation practice to appraise shares and businesses. Janet eventually realizes that Bill's billings to his clients, although not to her, are fraudulently inaccurate. So she is associated with somebody she has a professional relationship with, his business. And he, in the course of running his business, commits fraud. Now, he's not an accountant. He's not a member of the Institute of Chartered Accountants. Assuming Bill won't listen to Janet's rebuke, so we're doing away with the rebuke question, is Janet obligated to part ways with Bill? So, yeah, leaving aside the issue of Helkafa and rebuke, we're saying he won't listen. Leaving aside the issue of aiding those who sin, because she's not involved with his sin. What he's doing, his unethical conduct, is really beyond his relationship with her. Do we have a further obligation? So interestingly, based on the principles and rules of the ICAO, it seems like there is an obligation. Oh, I see. It's on the, you have to turn the page upside down. Okay, source number 7. This is from the Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 407-2. A member or firm engaged in a practice of public accounting to which another business or practice is related, or engaged in such related business or practice, shall be responsible to the Institute for any failure of a non-member who is associated with such related business or practice and who is under the member's or firm's management or supervision, or with whom the member or firm shares proprietary or other interest in such related business or practice, to comply with the rules of professional conduct. So there are too many clauses here for me, and there's too much jargon here for me. So I went to Steve and I said, under this rule, under 407-2, what would we say? Would we make the argument that that Sarah is required to part ways with Bill? And Steve's answer, I have it in an email, was yes. Do you stand by that answer?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of assuming that they were working together on the same kind of files. In other words, not that they were completely separate. In other words, if I were to consult someone on one matter for myself, you know, and then that person had other clients that would do something unethical, I wasn't assuming that was quite the situation. I was kind of assuming that I was using that person's information for my work.
Right.
And therefore, even though they were billing me properly, but there was some fraud going on.
Right, no, that's the case that I mean.
Oh, that's the case you mean. Okay, yeah. So there is an ongoing association.
Yes.
Yeah, I think clearly you have
to. It seems more serious than that. It seems like you're supposed to report that person to the
Guild. Only if they're a CA.
Right, you can't report them to the Guild if they're not members.
CA, but you have to not be associated with them.
Right. So, in fact, within halacha, within law, Jewish law, we have a similar principle. And the principle is called Al Tishaber La Rasha. Do not join with somebody who is wicked. And it comes from a couple of cases within Tanakh. One case I brought you here in source number 8, but I'm just going to state it outside, is when King Yehoshaphat, the king of Yehuda. Yeah, but you can't report them to the guild. There's nothing to report. They're not bound by their rules. You just have to separate from them.
For a non-member, they have no jurisdiction.
I don't know. What does it say?
You are responsible to the Institute for the fact that you are parted with somebody who's doing it.
The Institute member is responsible.
Right.
Yeah. So in source number 8, we find a message given to Yehoshaphat, who is the king of Yehuda, of Judea, the southern kingdom in Israel, in the days of the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash. And the message given to him is, Yehoshaphat, you joined forces with the wicked king Ahaziah. Therefore, as it's put here, God has destroyed your deeds. Paratz Hashem es Maasecha, and the ships were smashed, and they were unable to make the journey that they had wished to make. There's a punishment to him for joining forces with somebody who is wicked. Similarly, we are told that Amnon was a son of David HaMelech, of King David. He fell in love with his half-sister, Tamar, and he himself, as is described in the book of Shmuel, Shmuel Beth, Samuel 2, chapter 13, would never have harmed her, but he had a bad friend, a friend named Yonadav, and Yonadav gave him advice that led to, essentially, him raping his half-sister. That's the story there. And from that, we say, source number 9, the principle stated by Nitai HaArbeli, Nitai of Arbel, he says, Harchek mishachein ra, distance yourself from a bad neighbor, ve'al tischaber la'rasha, do not join with a wicked person, ve'al tisya'ish mena puranus, and do not abandon hope of punishment. The last point is beyond the scope of what we're talking about, but he states, and it's in the context of other lessons in Pirkei Avot, about the type of social circle you have and who your influences are. It's in the same section that says things like acquire a master, a mentor, a Rebbe for yourself, and so on. So he makes the statement that you can't join with a wicked person. It sounds like the reason is, and again, I would rather poll everybody about the reason, but in the interests of time, I'm not going to. One way to look at this is, it's because you're going to be influenced by them, like the story of Amnon, being influenced by his friend. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is that you encourage them, right? Because they do what they do. They engage in their activities saying, well, here's a righteous person. He likes me and hangs out with me. Obviously, what I do is not so bad. If what I did was really horrible, he wouldn't hang out with me. So your association with them reinforces them in their behavior. That's that's another consideration. If you take a look at source number 10, I couldn't resist this. This is remarkable. This is from a work called Todot Chatam Sofer. It records stories from the life of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer. It also appears in other accounts of his life. There's a work called Chut HaMishulash where it's supposed to appear, although I couldn't find it in there. But in any case, it talks about Ode His Hiram. He, the Chasam Sofer, warned them, his students, greatly, he umaod is hiram. Shayiyu dovrei ames bilavavam, that they should speak honestly from the heart. Viyu tocham kevaram, their inside and outside should be the same. Viyir, meaning no illusions. Viyirchaku bimitachave keshas me anshe sheker umirma. I wonder if it should be kimitachave. I cut and pasted from a text that wasn't great, so it probably should be kimitachave. They should distance themselves in arrows shot from people who are people of deceit. Even if they are people of Torah, the fact that somebody practices mitzvot and studies Torah does not mean, unfortunately, that he's always ethical. You have people, regrettably, who are not ethical, even though externally they appear to be great. So he says you have to distance yourself from them. And then we get a story. Vidachirna, the person telling this, says, I remember, Shesiperli Abazatzal, that my father, who was the son of the Chatam Sofer, told me, Al Talmud Chacham Echad, about a certain scholar, Shayagam Ashir, who was wealthy, Umechaber Sefer, and he had written books, meaning Torah books, Avominus Nizrikabo, but at some point he went off and became a little bit heretical. Vahaya Bogam Midos Lava Lahalbin Pnecha Pnecha Chamim Ulitzaharan, and he also used to embarrass the sages and he would cause them pain. So he had left the proper conduct. Sha'amar lo aviv hakadosh zatzal, and his father, meaning the Chasam Sofer himself, or Moshe Sofer, said, Taminli, he said, trust me. Ki chopam asher ishahu holech mi beisi. Every time that man leaves my house, miyad ani lokech li sefer musar lilmod bo. I immediately take a book of ethical instruction to study. Ki hevel pip shel oso ish mitameh. Because that man's breath communicates impurity. He wasn't one to mince words. He pretty much told it like it was. So the statement that he makes is that you have to be wary of such associations. So based on that, in my case that I presented here, does she have to part ways with him? So the answer is probably yes, but we do not necessarily require a great loss in order to do so. Meshulam Roth, who was a rabbi in Israel, a great leading figure in Israel in the 1940s and 1950s, was asked about joining a labor cooperative which operated two boats. And in one of them, there would be Jews who would be working on Shabbat. And the question was asked by the Jews who were in the other boat, are we considered to be associated with them? We consider this inappropriate conduct. They're not listening to us. So do we have to part ways? And his answer was, not necessarily, based on source number 11, which I'm not going to go through in depth now in the interests of time, but you can see it there. Tosfot there says, he has a problem. There's a concept in Talmudic times called arnona. Arnona is actually still a word in Israel today. It refers to a tax. So in those days, it was a head tax. It wasn't an income tax. It was just, you are a person, you have to pay a certain amount. So the concern was that come the Shemitah year, sabbatical year, you can't work your field, you're not going to have enough money to pay the head tax. And based on that, the sages permitted all sorts of activities in the fields. And the question is, what do you mean? You're permitting biblical violations in order to be able to pay the king's tax? How can you tell me that? That means I can go to work on Shabbat also for the sake of paying the king's tax? So so Tosfot offers two answers. One answer was that he was talking about Shemitah, the sabbatical year, in the time period when it was only a rabbinic law. It's not biblical Shemitah. Biblical sabbatical laws could not be overridden to pay the king's taxes. Only rabbinic could. That's his first answer. His second answer is absolutely justified, because if the king says, pay my tax, and you don't pay it, this isn't the CRA. All those commercials that they have on the radio where they talk about what's going to happen to you, like, this is real. They will throw you in jail if they're in a good mood. As he writes, they would die at the king's hands. So there's grave danger involved. So if I take his first answer, then I'm not justified in joining with this person in order to be able to make money. However, if I take a second answer, it's possible to argue that where this is a job I really need and I'm not going to survive without it, I can't put food on the table, I would be allowed to maintain this relationship until such time as I'm able to afford to break it off. That's the argument that one could make. So in dealing with this case, just to make sure to sum up what we've said, the statement is that I'm not supposed to be joined with people who are practicing something inappropriate, like the ICAO law in number 7, but we may have a leniency, and Rabbi Meshulam Roth relied on it, in a case where that's necessary for one's financial survival, until at least one can get out of the situation. Clear so far?
Without financial survival, the example you gave was more life survival that has to deal with finance.
Right. The thing is, life survival has to do with finances. I'm in the same boat, so to speak, if I can't pay, for food. Same problem. The last case is the case of flattering the boss. A religious school would like to hire Dror, a citizen of another country where people are named Dror, to serve as a receptionist. Sarah, the school's new office manager, contends that a labor market opinion is required. In order to legally hire Dror, you have to prove that you can't find somebody like that among native Canadians. But the school's CEO laughs and informs her Dror's position will be considered religious work, even though Dror's going to be a receptionist, and therefore will be exempt from this requirement, because indeed, if you're coming in to do religious work, the labor market opinion apparently is not required, based on the limited research that I did. So is Sarah obligated to endanger her job by protesting? Does she have an obligation to speak up? Assuming that he's not going to listen, right? So we take out our tochacha, the rebuke issue that we've already discussed. Assuming that she's not enabling his sin, so it's not misayeya, machzik yideyove avera, like we discussed last week. And there's no issue, let's say, of joining with, partnering with someone wicked, because it's her boss. It's not someone that she's actually associating with. He doesn't care about her opinion, and she's not close with him to be influenced. Let's take all of those assumptions. There's one more issue we have to discuss, which is the issue called chanufa, flattery. In source number 12, we are told, it's a passage from Mishle, from Proverbs, Amar l'rasha tzadik ata, if a person says about wicked people, you are righteous, yikvuhu amim yizamuhu le'umim, that person will be cursed and rebuked by nations. Meaning, you're not allowed to flatter somebody and tell them they're good, when in fact, They are not. That principle gets applied under this banner of Canupa in source number 13. King Agrippus was from the Second Temple times, and he was of questionable Jewish heritage. The Talmud debates exactly what his status was and just how Jewish he was, but apparently he wasn't Jewish enough to be able to serve as king over Israel. But he was king. And at one point, the sages were sort of put on the spot because there was a mitzvah called Haker, which is that every 7 years, the king is supposed to read publicly sections of the book of Devarim, of Deuteronomy. And one of the sections includes the mitzvah of your king has to be from among yourselves. You can't put a stranger, an outsider, upon yourself. This is much like the law in many countries. I don't know the law in Canada, but in the United States, you have to be a native citizen of the country. You can't be a naturalized citizen in order to serve as president of the United States. What's the law for the prime minister? Do you have to be a native of Canada? Interesting. Okay. And many countries have this rule because they're afraid of... In many countries, the rule is that you have to be a natural citizen, a native citizen, the reason being that otherwise you could have somebody who, in fact, comes from the outside with malicious intent, conceals it, becomes a citizen, and then starts working for a foreign power. Manchurian candidate sort of scenario. So we have such a law within the Torah too. So source 13 says, when King Agrippus read publicly the sentence of Lo suchal lasei salacha ish nachri, you shall not place a stranger upon yourself, zalgue nav de maos, he started to cry. Amrulam, the sages said to him, Al tis yare Agrippus, don't be afraid, Agrippus. Achinu ata, you are our brother. To which the Talmud comments, Ba'os sashah nishaibu sonei Yisrael klaya shechnifu lo l'Agrippus. The sages, it says the enemies of Israel as a euphemism, but what it means is the sages became liable for destruction for offering this flattery to Agrippus. What's wrong with flattering him? Two different approaches here on your sheet. Source number 14, the Meiri, writing in the 14th century, says that the problem is you cause other people to trust him and emulate him. When the sages say positive things about Agrippus, that leads to public approval for him. So that's the problem with flattery. In source 15, Tosfot indicates that you have a separate concern, two separate concerns. Number one, that you confirm him in what he's doing. You indicate to him that what he's doing is okay. And number two, you indicate that you're more afraid of that person than of God. Because here you are flattering this person and saying, oh, everything you're doing is wonderful. When in fact, it's anything but. So based on that, if I know someone is acting unethically, I am prohibited from saying what you're doing is great. So does that mean that in this case, Sarah's working in the office, she's brand new there, and the CEO talks about what he's doing, which is in fact unethical, that if Sarah says to him, good one, boss, she's guilty of the same thing that they're guilty of with King Agrippus. So the answer...
She already protested.
Well, she questioned. I don't know if that's right. That's part of our question. Is that in fact sufficient? Does the fact that she questioned it already show where her mind is on it? The answer seems to be that perhaps silence is an acceptable option. Perhaps the problem is only if you overtly state, as they did, you are our brother, you know, everything is fine. That may be where the problem actually lies. If you take a look at source number 16, we are told there you are allowed to flatter the wicked in this world, and they quote two sentences to support this. Those are cases of indirect flattery. Those are cases of an indirect type of a flattery, like when Yaakov in the second sentence here, when Jacob says to his brother Esav, "Seeing you is like seeing the face of God." He's doing it because his brother has a force of 400 men waiting to attack. But he hasn't said, and when you go out and hunt and kill people, that's actually a good thing. What he's provided is an indirect flattery. So Sarah says to the boss, not good strategy on hiring drawer, but that's a great tie you're wearing. So that's indirect. But even direct flattery gets approved. Take a look at source number 17, a bizarre story. Ula was a sage in Babylon in Bavel. He ascended to Israel. Well, he was accompanied by two people from Michoza, a big city. And as the story goes, Talmudically, Kam chad shachte l'chavrei, one of them got up and killed the other one. Amar le'ula ya'us abdi, he said to Ula, did I do well? As he's holding the knife, dripping with blood. Did I do well? Amar le'in, uprale beis hashchita, he said, oh yeah, absolutely, and you know what? You should make sure to open his throat so he dies faster. Ula said that because otherwise he's next. But now Ula gets to his destination. Ki asla kamed Rabbi Yochanan, he says to Rabbi Yochanan, his mentor, he says, did I do something wrong? And he said, no, nafshecha yitzalta, you saved your life. So that it's considered justified to save your life. Based on this, halachic authorities tend to be lenient in a case where there is fear. And I brought you Rabbi Elazar of Mitz in source number 18, who says so. He says it doesn't apply where you are afraid, only if you do it out of wickedness. And Tosfot, that we saw back in 15, I didn't read it explicitly, says they should have been silent. Silence is an option. So, we would prefer that you not overtly praise what they're doing, as Ula did. That's not a great option. He did it to save his life. If you have a choice, go for silence. That's really what we're saying. You should not praise people for doing things that are fundamentally unethical, that are fundamentally wrong. So that, to summarize, in our last minute here, number one, you see my summary on the bottom of the sheet. In our first case, where you had no professional connection, just that somebody asked you for tax advice as a friend, so we said you're supposed to offer rebuke. If they're going to sin intentionally, you might still need to rebuke once, but that's sufficient. And based on what we added today, certainly if there will be financial loss for you involved in rebuking, but that's a friend case, so that's not really so relevant. The professional case is the case in which the client submits fraudulent charitable gift receipts. So you have to avoid aiding wrongdoing. That's your principal requirement, is not to help. However, it's possible to argue the point of maybe you don't need to incur loss in such a case. I'm just looking back at the what we said last week. No, I think that's a mistake in my table. You cannot do it in order to avoid incurring loss. You would not be allowed to aid in it. The only exceptions we gave were where you are not actually enabling the sin. If you're not enabling the sin is happening going forward and so on without you, so then maybe there we would have an exception to the rule. And then the first case we did today, the case of the related business. So we said that you may not need to, we said you should not partner with people who are doing something wrong, but you may not need to incur loss. And then in the last case, flattering an unethical act. So in a case where there's danger of loss for you, you would be able to be silent in order to avoid a problem for yourself. I'm sorry again to have rushed so much. Come back next week, and God willing, the talk that week by Yeager Manis.